The South Akron Youth Mentorship is exactly what the name implies. These folks mentor the youth of Akron, Ohio. If you would like to volunteer or perhaps help with a charitable donation, please visit saymentor.org and find out how you can help out today. That's saymentor.org.
Welcome to the Phil Nason's Show.
Welcome to the Phil Nason Show. I'm happy to have you here. We'll be here for the entire hour, and we'll talk some Australian Open tennis. We'll do our weekly fantasy basketball and fantasy hockey episodes, as well as a goodbye to Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub. A big fan of this show, by the way. But up first, one of the big reasons why this show has been nominated for Podcast of the Year is my next guest. And he's here to talk about a 16-game winning streak. If you folks thought the Hawks sucked, you ain't been watching the NBA. And joining me to do just that from PeachtreeHoops.com, Chris Willis is in the house. Chris, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Doing good, Phil. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. The Hawks just keep rolling.
They do, don't they? They're amazing. I thought they would be good, but not this good. Wow, they just don't seem to be letting up, do they? Last night they knocked off Minnesota. I figured they'd win that one, but my goodness, it's the way they're doing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody saw them putting everything together and being this good. Like you said, I mean, they just keep passing every test. They take each game one game at a time, and you know, actually, Sunday's game probably wasn't their best effort. Minnesota shot 52% from the field, but, you know, Hawks never really felt threatened in that game. They pulled away when they had to. So, yeah, it's been a remarkable run. I mean, they've opened up a sizable lead in the Eastern Conference now. And, you know, you're sitting here wondering, you know, could they possibly run away with this thing, which, you know, seemed crazy to think about early in the season.
I think it's very likely that they could, you know, barring a major injury. I think they look pretty good. A lot of listeners were curious, and I am too. I have my own signature win, I suppose, which is the win during this recent 16-game streak that you went, okay, this is really a good team.
Probably the win at Portland. That was the eye opener for me. I mean, that was a team that was playing well, although they didn't have Robin Lopez, but they were very tough to beat at home. They were playing well. Hawks went in there and, you know, just took care of business. That was eye opening for me, to see them defend the way they did and to really just take it to them on the second night of a back to back. I think that was, the biggest eye opener for me during the stretch.
You've been reading my notes because that's what I have too. And one of the things, you know, I host a podcast, a Blazers podcast with Dave Decker from Blazers Edge. And I didn't think that the Hawks would beat this team. I thought for sure that Portland, especially at home, would take care of their business. They had a tough game the night before against Utah. And I'm thinking, okay, this is just going to be one of those nights where the home team wins. You know, it's a long road trip. It was a tough road trip. And they just came out there and took it to them for four quarters. And that's what this basketball team's all about. That's when I went, okay, these guys really are good. They're better than I thought they were. But one of the things that amazes me is how it's a different guy every night, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, that's been the remarkable thing about this team all year. You know, one night it's Jeff Teague that kills you. The next night it's Al Horford. You know, it's Paul Millsap against Thunder on Friday night. You know, I mean, it's somebody else. It's Kyle Korver. It's somebody off the bench. I mean, they can just hurt you so many ways. If you take Jeff Teague away, then that opens up Al Horford and Kyle Korver. If you try to take the perimeter away, then Paul Millsap kills people in the post. But, you know, I still say the difference in this team being a good team and a great team has been their effort defensively. You know, they're among the league leaders in defensive rating and points per game allowed. I mean, that's remarkable. You know, Al Horford meant a lot. The additions of Thabo Sefolosha and Kent Bazemore have paid dividends. But I don't think anybody saw the defensive improvement from this team, you know, coming. That's been the biggest change.
Oh, I agree with you. I remember we talked about this a few weeks ago, how they were not highly ranked efficiency-wise. Now, they had had a tough time, and it was like early in the season. I think, what did they start? 5-5, right?
Yeah, I believe they were 5-5 and 7-6 at one point. I mean, they gave up 114-something points, I think, to the Lakers early in a home loss. I mean, they lost at home. They gave up 126 points to Toronto before they really started this run. You know, they were some feeling out going on early on. Bazemore wasn't playing a lot. It took a little time for everybody to get on the same page. But, boy, when they did, everything's just clicked. I mean, they rotate. They play together, and that's the most important part. It's not just one guy going out there and defending and protecting the rim. It's those guys playing as a unit. And covering for each other, and you know, not having any lapses, and it's been remarkable, really. I mean, it's refreshing. You know, the NBA is a superstar driven league, but you know, the Hawks team is a group, a unit, and you know, it's almost like a college atmosphere almost watching them play.
Oh, yeah, I agree. You know, that defense has been fantastic since the Toronto game on the 26th, where they got. Or Toronto hung 126 on him. Since then, they've only given up triple digits 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times, 8 times, and every one of those were a win. These guys are just amazing. It really is. The defense is – what they did against Oklahoma City this past weekend was just phenomenal. And that's just a big credit to the coaching staff. Now, we got a couple of games coming up this week. Brooklyn – you got the rematch at home with Portland and then Philly on the road on Saturday night. What do you expect here? You expect this thing to continue?
I don't see why it can't. You know, first things first, there's an underlying theme to that Brooklyn game. You know, the Hawks have the rights to swap first-round picks with the Nets by virtue of the Joe Johnson deal. So, you know, Atlanta could theoretically end up as a – number one seed in the Eastern Conference, and if the Nets miss a playoff, also come away with a lottery pick. So, you know, any loss they can hang on Brooklyn is huge at this point. You know, it would really benefit them if the Nets missed a playoff. And then, of course, you know, Friday's rematch with the Blazers. I know LaMarcus Aldridge is banged up a little bit, but he didn't look like it the other night because he had a wonderful game against the Wizards. But you know, that's going to be a fun game. That's great matchups all over the floor. So it's going to be fun to see how Portland comes into Atlanta and tries to make adjustments to counteract kind of what happened up in Portland earlier.
Well, the bench has gotten better for Portland, but it's not as good as Atlanta's. That's the other thing about Atlanta that people just walk away from right off is that bench is playing pretty good.
Yeah, it's not just one guy. It's kind of like the rest of the team. I mean, one night it might be Dennis Schroeder. Next night it might be Mike Scott. But, you know, if you remember that Portland game, man, the Hawks just wailed away at the paint. It was like Portland was so concerned with Atlanta's perimeter game that it was just layup after layup off the pick and roll. And I'll be interested to see what kind of adjustments they make this time around. If they, you know, just really try to run the Atlanta off the 3-point line, or if they make some significant adjustments in their pick and roll coverage.
Well, I look for them to make adjustments. Terry Stotts is a terrific coach. And then Saturday, Philly. Now, Philly's the second worst team in the East. That distinction belongs to the worst one being my New York Knicks. They're awful, really awful. But Philly is not much better. That one is at home as well. That should be fun for the home team, eh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Philly, those games like that, longtime Hawks fans, those games like that just scare us to death. But, you know, Philly's undermanned from a talent perspective. They do play hard, though. And, you know, that's a testament to Brett Brown, who's another Spurs disciple. So, you know, the Hawks have done a good job getting ready for even the lesser opponents. Like I said, Sunday's game against Minnesota wasn't the sharpest. But, you know, they still did everything they need to do to win. So that's a game they need to get, especially at Phillips Arena.
Yeah, there's definitely a couple of traps in the schedule. Brooklyn, they're reeling. They're in big trouble. I don't know what to say about that team. But Philly's going to play hard. They will play hard. That's one thing I'll give them. But they're not going to beat Atlanta, even on a fluke. it's not going to happen, especially at home. The Portland one is the one that makes you nervous. And then next week, there's a whole bunch of stuff coming up, and we'll talk about all that next week. Chris, great stuff this week. Thanks again, and good luck with the Hawks this week.
Thanks, Phil. It's always a pleasure talking ball with you.
Thank you, my friend. That was Chris Willis, and you can catch him over at PeachtreeHoops.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. Welcome back to The Phil Nason Show. It's fantasy basketball time, and joining me to do just that, to talk and help you win your league, please welcome from rotowire.com, Alex Reclean is in the house. Alex, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I thought we were going to talk about the LaMarcus Aldridge injury, but it turns out that he is playing again. What do you think about the whole thing? What would you do with LaMarcus Aldridge if he was on your roster?
If you were on my roster, I would hold on to him. What I would actually say is if he's not on your roster, I think this is a great buy low opportunity. It is really scary when you get that ESPN alert on your phone saying that your first or second round pick is going to miss 6 to 8 weeks because he needs surgery. And then all of a sudden he's still playing. That's going to spook LaMarcus Aldridge owners. But LaMarcus Aldridge is one of the toughest players in the league. Go to his Wikipedia page. Look through the injuries he has played through throughout his career. This guy suffers injuries 2 and 3 times as serious as Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, but he misses 1/3 as many games. I trust him to play through it. If he's making the decision to keep going, I think he is good to go. And I think LaMarcus Aldridge owners are going to be skittish after that scare last week. So I think he's a great buy low option. If he's on your team, I would hold on to him. I trust LaMarcus Aldridge. I don't like drafting him because he has these injury risks. But once he got him, he's such a great producer.
He's on every one of my teams. And you know what? When you talk about ESPN alerts, I do a Portland Trailblazers show. And good grief. And then he comes back. It's kind of like Willis Reedian. You know, he just comes back when we don't expect him to come back. And it was amazing. And it's great for basketball. I have him on several teams, too. And I was a little nervous. I almost dropped him in one league, almost. And then I decided, okay, I'm winning it by 8 points in a roto league. So I think I can save myself and save him for a couple of weeks and see what happens. And I'm glad that I did because he's just fantastic. Now, what about a lot of listeners are talking about Eric Gordon. What do you do with Eric Gordon?
Eric Gordon is worth picking up if he meets what you're looking for in terms of your categorical goals. He's had such terrible injuries, and it's been a shame to watch. But I just remember watching that guy as a freshman out in I think it was in Indiana. He was so explosive, and he had such a great ability. And he seems to be finding a role. The expectations are finally down on him, so I don't think he's carrying such an emotional burden every time he's out there. And he had, 8 or 9 games in a row, scoring double digits, hit 20 points 3 times in that stretch. He's averaging a little bit over 5 assists per game over the last 10 or 11 games, 3-ish rebounds. Those are quality numbers. That's worth ownership in most leagues.
Yeah, I agree with you. And speaking of teams with games this week, Boston, Cleveland, Dallas, Denver, the Los Angeles Clippers, Memphis, Minnesota, the hapless Knicks, Philadelphia, Portland, Sacramento, and Toronto all have 4 games. Charlotte and San Antonio have only 2. I'm going to wait a week before I pick up Gordon because he doesn't have 4 games this week, but he's a pickup. He definitely is. He's straight across the board, and that's any league. Even a 10-team league I would do because he's having a good little year. And the great thing is it's going to continue as long as he's healthy because everyone's forgetting about him. Defenses forget about him. You know, they got enough to worry about him.
And he's got so much upside. I mean, even if he's just a third the player we hoped he would be, that's still a really good player. I agree. I think he's probably worth picking up in most leagues.
I think in my auction league, I got him for a buck.
You overpaid it based on preseason values, although he's paying off now.
Well, yeah, I always overpay for those last rounds. But it's okay because everybody does.
Exactly.
And the thing is that you got to look for a steal. And, you know, one of the things that I thought about when I thought about him was the team he plays on. If those other guys are doing well, he's going to do well because they're going to start keying on these guys. And now they'll leave Gordon alone. And I hope they continue to leave Gordon alone. But, yes, by all means, do pick him up. This week, that's up to you. He's got three games. But next week, I think he has four. What about Brandon Wright? Now, Brandon Wright was having a really good little season at the beginning. Then he got traded a couple of times. What do you do with Brandon Wright? Do you pick him up?
I wouldn't. I'd leave him out there. I don't think he's playing enough. I think that Phoenix is more invested in a lot of its other big men. I think that they still really want to see what they have. I think they want to give Alex Len, you know, proper time to develop on the court. I think that they're still not 100% sure what they have in Plumlee. And the Morris brothers, I think that they really want to keep both of them happy because I think they want to keep them both around for a while. And so even if ability-wise Wright deserves to be out there, I think he becomes the odd man out just because of who else is there. And I'm not sure ability-wise that he is any better than any of those guys. They're not using him very much. Unless you need blocks in a deep league, I'd leave him.
Yep, I'm leaving him be completely. Really, I am. But you want to talk about blocks. Oh, Maron, what is this kid, Hassan Whiteside? Who in the heck is he? Why is he in my life like this? That triple-double was incredible with all these blocks.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
Daily players have probably taken note of Hassan Whiteside over the last couple of weeks. He's been a very good value in daily leagues for last 2 to 3 weeks or so. And so he's not a totally foreign name to that very small group of the population. He's not the most consistent player, but I mean, 12 blocks last night is the headline, of course. But looking quickly down, he's got 5 blocks twice, 4 blocks once, and 3 blocks twice in his last 15 games. This isn't just a one-time thing. He is a rim protector. He is a solid center. He is a double-double threat. And he gets occasional steals. It's fun when you can have a big man who throws in steals in addition to blocks.
Oh, absolutely. We talk about him on our Miami Heat report here, and he's a guy I've already picked up in a couple of leagues, and I'm really happy. Daily fantasy guys, he's still a steal, by the way. He's really cheap, really cheap. But, yeah, by all means, if you get the chance to grab him, do it. Even if they're only playing 3 games, he's going to get you blocks. That's no fluke. Now, we had a question, a trade. We've got 2 minutes. That's all this will take. Tyson Chandler for DeAndre Jordan.
It depends on the settings, and it depends on what you need. If you want to absolutely tank free throws, then DeAndre Jordan is better across the board. But he kills you in free throws, and there is no coming back from DeAndre Jordan in free throws. I don't want to hear about what if you have – you know, James Harden, then do they balance out? No, they don't balance out. Do the math. DeAndre Jordan kills your free throws. The only teams who might be almost as bad are teams with Dwight Howard or Andre Drummond. DeAndre Jordan is a little bit better than Tyson Chandler across the board, but he ruins you in a category. Depends on your settings, depends on your team needs.
I'm not picking that. I'm not taking that trade. If I have Tyson Chandler, I'm keeping him. He's on a decent team, not to say the Clippers aren't, but you've got the chance for big numbers from Tyson Chandler, especially when they play against weak links, you know, like when he did against the Knicks. You know, we went for, 20 points and 24 rebounds? Those are big nights. He's going to do stuff like that 5 or 6 times a season.
That is one big difference, is late in the season, Tyson Chandler has more of a guarantee on his workload because Tyson Chandler plays in the crunch and DeAndre Jordan spends a lot of fourth quarters on the bench.
Because he can make free throws. You know, that's something that you brought that up. That was a great point. Keep an eye on the free throw percentages because in the fourth quarter, teams are doing that. Look what happened with Rajon Rondo in Dallas. He got sat down because his free throws are awful. Alex, great stuff today. Thanks for being on the show. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you as always.
Always great talking with you, my friend. That's Alex McLean. You can catch him over at rotowire.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. Welcome back to The Phil Nason Show. Baseball lost an incredible, incredible athlete and a face of Major League Baseball when Ernie Banks passed away at the age of 83 of a heart attack. And here to join me to talk all about Mr. Cub and what he meant to baseball and the Cubs, please welcome Rush Olson to the show. Rush, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I am well. Thank you for having me, Phil.
Thank you for being here. You know, he used to say a line, "It's a great day for baseball, let's play too." But I'm thinking it's a sad day for baseball because we have to say goodbye to you. And it's going to be tough to say goodbye to Ernie Banks.
I don't think you ever read or encounter anybody that doesn't think Ernie Banks was just a tremendous person and made incredible contributions to the game. He was the statement you just made just summed up to me one of the things that I loved about Ernie Banks, which was the guy just embraced baseball. He just thought the game was the greatest thing ever, and he wanted to play all the time. And he played a long career, a successful career, a Hall of Fame career, and his "Let's Play Two" was a signature phrase for him and for baseball. I used it in a video once for the Rangers just because it was such a great piece of baseball history.
It absolutely is. You know, I had the privilege of meeting him many years ago in Las Vegas. I played in a pro-am with him, and he was fantastic. And he still kept in touch. I sent him a Facebook friend request.
Yes.
And he remembered me. He was such a nice man and a big fan of the show. You know, a big fan of the show. He was a fantastic human being, dude, and one of the nicest people out there. But one thing that I just came away with was how in awe other baseball players were of him, like Pete Rose, for example, and others. The way they looked at him, the way they listened when he spoke. You know, you're talking about a legend of the game, and it's just amazing. And the way he carried himself, you could tell that he didn't think he was that big a deal. But he knew that you thought he was, and he was always going to be that way for you, and it was just fantastic. But one of the disappointments when we talk about his career was that he played more games, more regular season games without a postseason appearance, but you couldn't tell by that smile on his face because it never left his face.
No, he loved to play, and he deserved better. He deserved to be to have that postseason experience and to have that even greater joy of holding a trophy. In fact, one of the sad things about the timing of his passing is that the Cubs have just positioned themselves for the best time, their best position in you know, since, let's say, 1945, to be that team that is going to win one eventually. I mean, some of the moves they've made, their team looks great, and it looks great for the future. And you're sad that if they do end up winning one, that Ernie Banks wouldn't get to ride in the parade, because he'd be good on a parade. He'd be really good.
Oh yeah. You ain't kidding there. And you know what else, what I'm going to miss, but then I guess we won't miss it anymore because WGN's not going to show the games, is they would show Mr. Cub when he was there.
Sure.
And all he had to do was stand up and wave, and the place went nuts. And that's a guy who played on some really bad teams, but he was fantastic. Back-to-back MVPs.
Well, you know, he was from Dallas, which that's the area that I'm from. I'm from Fort Worth. And he grew up here. He played here. And I never got to meet Ernie Banks, but I did get to meet the guy that turned him on to pro baseball, which was William Blair. And William Blair was a former Negro Leagues pitcher, and he spotted Ernie Banks playing high school softball. His high school didn't even have a baseball team. He was playing softball and recognized Ernie Banks' talent and was able to get him he started playing in the Negro Leagues with the Kansas City Monarchs. And then eventually the Cubs picked him up from the Monarchs. But it was fascinating to listen to William Blair, who also unfortunately recently passed away, tell the story of how he found Ernie Banks. And we did an interview with him once where he talked about that. And there was a collection of Negro Leagues museum memorabilia that had come to on a tour to Texas for the Rangers. And we got him to walk through and talk about that. And William Blair was a fascinating character in himself, but his claim to fame was that he was probably the guy that discovered Ernie Banks.
Great discovery. Great discovery. Yes. Listen to this. 67.5 wins above replacement in his career. That's nuts. Look at this. In 1959, when he won the National League MVP, 10.2 runs of wins above replacement. 9.4 in the year he won the MVP in 58. This guy was something, man. What a baseball player. Now, you guys, you out there, you think that these guys get overpaid. He got $2,000 for his first season. In his last season, he got $60,000. So he made overall in 19 years, $680,500. That's how much a minor leaguer signs for his signing bonus. Incredible.
Yeah, he did it in an era where it wasn't guaranteed that you were going to do well, but he was the kind of guy where if you say he would have, you need to play for free, it sounds like he might have done it because he just thought the game was the be all and end all.
Sure, he would have been the same way if he were a milkman or a salesman or the mayor or whatever. Technically, he's the mayor of Chicago,
right? I noticed that the mayor of Chicago moved the statue that had been in front of Wrigley Field until this most recent construction, moved it to City Hall so that it can be displayed there and in front of City Hall and people can come and see it.
That's a great thing, too, because no one wants to go down to Wrigley. They're all following me with the WGN ban. But I think this was fantastic.
Well, what a life. Is because it's under construction. But
what's that?
I not to discount your influence, Phil, but the main reason that the statue isn't there is because they're doing renovations on Wrigley Field. Now, of course, a lot of it, you know, probably is you, of course.
Well, yeah, you know what? But I understood all the renovations, but we're working hard on this WGN thing, though. We're not letting this slide. But Ernie Banks was fantastic. What an athlete. My goodness. When you think about his influence, and it just didn't cover the baseball world. He had influence everywhere. He was one of those charismatic personalities who you could trust and who you could respect. And he did a lot of things off the field as well. I mean, this was a fantastic human being.
Sure. And, you know, he maintained a long career. He moved to first base. He originally had been a shortstop and a good one. And then he moved to first base after some injuries. And then he continued to hit. I mean, I was looking up a little bit of the 1969 Cubs, which are probably the most heartbreaking, you know, one of the most heartbreaking Cubs teams ever, and that's saying something. But Ernie Banks, at the age of 38, he still drove in 106 runs. He hit 23 home runs, played 155 games, and contributed to that team that had Billy Williams and Ron Santo and Glenn Beckert and Milt Pappas and a host of excellent players that just didn't quite break through.
Yep, that was the year the Miracle Mets came through.
Indeed.
It broke the Cubs fans' hearts. I'm a Mets fan because of that season, though, by the way. But I was four then, so.
Well, and I you know, it's funny because I obviously, having my father grew up in Chicago, Cubs fan, I've, you know, obviously had some allegiance to the Cubs. But it's also, I remember when I first learned about that season, it was from a Mets point of view because there are books written and stuff like that. And it's hard to not be a fan of the Mets that year as well.
Yeah, but the Cubs, they had a really good team. You know, that was the Cubs were the Mets' real rival. It's not the Philadelphia Phillies, for example. Nobody cares about them until like 1977. So what's the difference about them? But Ernie Banks was a big reason why. And Met fans hated the Cubs, but they didn't hate him.
No, it would be hard to hate for anybody to hate Ernie Banks.
Damn near impossible. 512 home runs, 1,636 RBIs. He had 90 triples. He had 407 doubles, 2,583 hits all told in 9,421 appearances. He was incredible, man. There was nobody like Ernie Banks, and it's going to be tough. But you know what? Life goes on, but we still have the great memories of anyone who ever saw him or met him, and he will live on forever. Rush, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. That was Rush Olson. You can find him over at rusholson.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
The Phil Nason Show will return after these brief messages.
Riveting talk radio.
People cannot get away from the internet.
Well,
now.
I think it probably comes from porn as well.
You know?
I mean, that's got to be a big, strong thing.
Oh, that's gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Dog radio. Bend over, baby.
That was great.
FanDuel and the Phil Nason Show have partnered to bring you a very special offer. FanDuel will give you a 100% signing bonus of up to $200 with your first-time initial deposit. To receive this bonus, simply sign up at FanDuel using the promo code PhillyFlash and go win some cash with a flash at FanDuel.com.
Central Portugal's only English-speaking information station, this is Epics Radio. Listen online, www.epicsradio.com.
If you're looking for a great Portland Trail Blazers talk radio show, then look no further than the Blazers Edge podcast with Dave Deckard and Phil Nasons. For weekly hard-hitting commentary about your Trailblazers and fun NBA talk as well, please try the Blazers Edge podcast at BlazersEdge.com.
Maximum Sports Channels is more than just a radio station. Phil's fantasy sports blog, the writer's Garrett, up-to-the-minute news feeds, great sports and entertainment commentary, Maximum Sports TV, including professional powerboat racing, and of course, the hottest music on the planet. Maximum Sports Channels. We're more than just a radio station.
You're listening to AFR, the Armed Forces Radio Network.
Hi, we're Rolf Folkert, and you're listening to Phil Nason Show.
To the Phil Nason Show. It's fantasy hockey time, and joining us to do just that, please welcome from rotowire.com, Brian Rutherford is in the house. Brian, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Doing well. Missing hockey. I mean, I know All-Star Game weekend is fun and all, but I'm missing some hockey. Need my FanDuel days back.
Yeah, there you go. I haven't had too much time for FanDuel because I'm up to something else, that I can't talk about really yet. But here's the thing.
I'm excited for you.
Yeah, I am too. You know, I am too. But fantasy hockey time. And this week, teams with four games are Arizona, Montreal, Nashville, Pittsburgh, and Washington. And the teams with two games each, Boston, Colorado, Los Angeles, Ottawa, and San Jose. Now, we have some bunch of back-to-backs, and we'll probably get through that a little bit while we do the show. But a lot of people want to know if you have any post-All-Star game advice for these fantasy hockey general managers.
Well, first and foremost, working off of your four-game schedules, keep in mind Washington's got two back-to-back occurrences, so you might want to keep an eye on their goalie situation in your FA pool. How about a fire sale in Toronto? just kidding here, Phil. I mean, the point being, though, is keep your eye on the trade rumors. RotoWire especially does an awesome deadline day forum. You can get great spec there. But, you know, players on the move over the next couple of weeks, it's not necessarily what you know, how it impacts the team that's acquiring them, but how it opens a slot for a fiery young blue chipper. So if Anton Vermette really does get dealt, then perhaps you're going to see the debut of Max Domi. That's more wishful thinking on my part, but the point being is you want to really keep an eye on the individual statistics of young AHL talent, as well as maybe second or third line guys that could be demoted as a result of the receiving team on a trade. There's a lot of stuff there when it comes to trade spec. Obviously, you've got some big names that are pending return to their lineup. Sidney Crosby got an injection, over this week. Ryan Murray has been cleared to practice. Jimmy Howard may return next week. And then big news here recently, Sergei Bobrovsky, looks like he's got a pretty serious groin injury. That might make Columbus buyers on the trade market. Obviously, backup goalies continue to be a worthy investigation, not only this season, but just because as the season strength, you know, goes on further, just as we just mentioned here, you've got veteran goalies that are beginning to tweak muscles. And then organizations are going to put their eye towards either the playoffs or the future. So, I mean, you've got all kinds of balls in the air right now, for lack of a better term. This is an exciting part of the year. It really is.
You know, it is. We talked about the Toronto Maple Leafs on Friday's show. They have six unrestricted free agents, Mike Santarelli, Daniel Winnick, Cody Franson, David Booth, Corbinian Holzer, Trevor Smith, and those guys could get dealt, and you want to watch for that. You want to keep your eyes out for those trades because you're going to see a lot of different things happen. There are teams that are going to make moves. Hockey isn't like basketball. You're going to see moves made, and that was good advice about the AHL. You want to check these guys and see what's happened, especially if you are on a legacy or in a legacy league or a keeper league like a lot of guys that listen to this show are. You want to keep an eye on those AHL discoveries. You never really know. And that's the great thing about fantasy hockey. We got some questions. Zach Bogosian, should somebody pick him up? Because he's playing pretty good for Winnipeg, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's got 3 goals plus 8 in January. Why not? Always been a supporter of Bogosian. What's not to like? The Jets, they have the firepower to be explosive at times. They're averaging just below 4 goals a game this month, and he usually reaps the rewards on that. Now, over the course of his career, he does seem to break down a little bit, specifically in February, where he's only managed to play 10 games or more twice over the course of his seven-year career. So that is kind of a red flag there. Maybe he's trained hard enough this year. Maybe he shakes that a little bit. There's really no telling with him, but based on the number of games on Winnipeg's schedule, they got 12 in February, 14 in March. I'd have to say no on that alone, but I might have to gamble on him depending on my roster situation. Again, it always comes down to who you're talking about dropping to pick him up.
That's exactly right. They don't have a lot of games left, but the one thing that intrigues me is he's playing a lot of points on the power play, and a lot of his points come off the power play. I like that. He does get a lot of shots on goal. He's had 9 shots on goal in his last 5 games. I like that too. But I'm a guy who looks at the schedule and looks at how many games they play. You know, he plays about 22 minutes a game, 21 minutes a game. That's a good thing. But if he's only playing 26 games on his way out, that's not a good thing. So I would be careful with the Winnipeg Jet defenseman. I would pick him up if I needed somebody. But like Brian said, you have to look at your roster and you have to weigh it all out. Now, what about Jaromir Jagr? Back in the old days, it wouldn't have been a question. You would have kept him. But do you keep him? He's 49% owned, so he's widely available. What do you do with Jaromir Jagr?
It's the age-old question. When does Father Time call in his loan? You know, I mean, even when you think this guy's slumping, though, he'll go out and he'll grab a hat trick. Decent amount of hockey ahead of him with 27 games combined between February and March. Plus, minus, and mini slumps are definitely hurting you. I get it. But a 6-game homestand starting in the middle of February could certainly help. He rakes way too much in March, Phil. I can't in good conscience suggest dropping him. At least get some value for him in a trade if you can wait it out.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I would pick him up, too. If I needed a forward, I would pick him up. I wouldn't care.
I would. I would gamble on him if he's available.
Yeah, I don't care how old he is. The guy, like Brian says, he can go out there and get a hat trick for you, and he's done that at his age. I think last week, he's the oldest player to record a hat trick, right? He's fantastic. So, and I know he slumps, and he has his little mini cold streaks, but then when he gets hot, he's worth it. And he's a great pickup in daily fantasy. And now we've got one more, Mike Fisher from Nashville. Do you keep or do you drop Mike Fisher?
Mr. Underwood himself, putting up decently pedestrian numbers, but just a little off of his pace, his career season pace. You know, the Preds are playing 15 games in both February and March. So, you know, you've got plenty of chances to pick up the pace there. Question is will he remain healthy? You know, he's a pedestrian NHL player. So, I mean, his career numbers in February, they take a dip like everybody else's and then soar again in March. You know, I've always dug Fisher as that kind of, you know, spec guy you pick up for a week or two and see if he flies. But I just having him on my team on a permanent basis, I just, again, we've been talking about this all season. There's just this stagnancy that comes from the Nashville Predators from previous just, you know, terrible offenses. I really like what they've done there, and I'm just nervous as to whether or not they can keep up the pace as the season draws to a close. Unless you're dropping them for the next big thing, again, get something in a deal for them. You know, but don't drop the second line center straight up. Too many tilts in his near future. The Preds could hit high gear. I like their chances. I might have to go ahead and keep him. I've never personally been a Mike Fisher guy, but, you know, to each their own.
I'm recommending him to be picked up off the waiver wire this week. They have 4 games. He's going to get his opportunities. Over the last 5, he's averaged 3 shots on goal a game, and he's had 3 goals and 1 assist during that period. He's a streaky guy, too, and I like streaky guys.
They've got 2 tilts with Colorado this week. I mean, that's right there alone. Colorado's sort of a sieve. So maybe he gets in on the action.
And that's what I'm thinking. And I would pick him up at least for this week because you got 4 games, 2 against Colorado. That's a nice little thing. And they should be okay. And he should be okay. And if you know what, if he doesn't work out for you this week, drop him and go get somebody else. I mean, that's just what you do. And they have a lot of games
week
coming
to week.
Up. Yep.
He's a week-to-week guy.
Run a streamer for 1 slot on your roster and use him there, and then just keep finding somebody else. Brian, great stuff today. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
All right, that was Brian Rutherford, and you can find him at rotowire.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. We're wrapping up an amazing sports day and talking about sports and having a great time. Big tournament down in Australia. Week 2 is officially here. And joining me to talk all about that is my partner on another show called This Week in Tennis. Please welcome Craig Doyle to the show. Craig, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing very well, Phil, and thanks for welcoming me to your daily show.
My small one.
You're a very small one, apparently.
Yeah, I'm too small for podcast one. I don't really care. It is what it is, but you know the big story down there in Australia is the heat. And we talk about this on our weekly show called This Week in Tennis. What's the story with the heat? Is it really that bad? It's because there's a deal here. And for you folks who don't understand how the Australian Open works, if the temperature gets above 40 Celsius, that's 104 degrees Fahrenheit, they're supposed to halt play whenever the at an even situation, during even games. And the players are not happy. The spectators are not happy. In fact, one spectator is suing the Australian Open. What is the story down there?
Well, the story down there is it's the climate. And, you know, it's in the Southern Hemisphere. It's the middle of the summer period. And it gets hot. I mean, on court level, it gets unbearably hot. I mean, people like us, you know, we'd be going to the beach in these temperatures. And these people are being asked to play in these temperatures, the players, but the spectators sitting together in these arenas. You know, all these people in such close proximity, the body heat combined with the ambient temperature in these arenas is absolutely scorching. And of course, you know, you mentioned the extreme heat policy regarding cancelling play at a certain temperature. It's to protect the safety of the players and the spectators.
But does it? I don't think it does. There's a lot of people complaining about this. And it is a sad thing to see. It's the season, how do I put this? I think they do it too early in the month of January. They should have put it back to February where it'd be a little cooler, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, ideally they could. But, of course, that conflicts with other tour schedules and contracts that are related to other tournaments on the tour and various tennis politics that are exceedingly complicated and difficult to navigate. So, you know, there's obviously restrictions there. And I've no doubt that there's restrictions with regards to other sports and the scheduling of the TV rights, etc. down in Australia. So obviously there's a lot of complications involved. So moving it to the prime weather spot might not be so easy.
So what do they need to do? See someone die out there? Because that's what's going to happen at some point. Someone's heart is going to blow up there.
It's been close. I mean, last year we had several players struggling in the heat. Obviously, from the sports performance perspective, and you're going to know this better than I do, but it's going to be difficult for players to play at their maximum capacity out there and put on the best show possible for spectators. So it's... I think this year's not been so bad. They've gotten a little bit lucky, especially in the first week. It hasn't been too bad during a lot of the day sessions, but it's just one of those things, you know. It's always sunny in Australia, and it always rains in Wimbledon.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to play out there. I've had the privilege of teaching tennis in two of the hottest places on earth, Corfu, Greece, and Las Vegas, Nevada. And I'll tell you what, it does hamper your ability to do things. It really does. Now, big story down there. Fed crashed out. Roger Federer crashed out early. And now what we have now, basically, is a crazy wide-open tournament, right?
Yeah, I mean, Roger was obviously a big part of the draw. A lot of people were expecting him to reach the semifinal stage or the final stage. When he disappeared, that's opened the door for a variety of other players who were in that quarter, that half of the draw. So it's definitely an interesting draw from the men's perspective, and the unpredictability of the draw has, I guess, it's added a little bit more interest to the tournament.
It sure has. Now, Andy Murray, he had a great match against Grigor Dimitrov, better known as Maria Sharapova's boyfriend, and Murray looks good now. I think Murray's going to win this tournament.
Yeah, well, that's quite possible. He's the he was in that Roger Federer section that we just mentioned, so the draw's kind of opened up a little bit in front of him. He's not playing Roger Federer in the quarterfinals now. He's playing Nick Kyrgios, a player he would potentially expect to beat at this stage in his career. He could face Rafael Nadal, who's looked a little out of sorts. So the path for Murray is certainly a lot brighter than it was at the start of last week when the tournament was beginning.
And Stan Wawrinka, the defending champion, he's got a pretty straight shot too, right?
Yeah, I mean, Stan's had a really, really kind draw from the start. He's been placed in with several players that he would definitely expect to beat. He may get a bit of a challenge out of Kei Nishikori, or maybe David Ferrer might give him a bit of a challenge out on court. But, you know, he looks like he's going to get a semi-final with Novak Djokovic. So that could be a key match in determining who wins this tournament.
And none of them are playing very well. And if you want to hear more about the men, you can tune into This Week in Tennis. That's you can find it easily. I'll even leave a link in the show notes. Now, the girls' side of things, the women's side of things, you've got an interesting quarter here with Eugenie Bouchard against Maria Sharapova, an all pinup model match.
Yeah, it's a big one. It's the one they're, you know, they're selling the posters and running the TV adverts for already. That's a huge quarterfinal, and you know, it just has that little added spice to it. Eugenie Bouchard, she's, you know, the next big thing from Canada. Sponsor's dream, modeling contracts, going to be sitting on the table waiting for her. But the question is she going to break through this year? She made a huge stride up the rankings last year into the top 10. She's not won a Grand Slam yet, but she's come close. So, you know, can she dethrone, or, well, you know, someone who's been there and done it in Sharapova? Is she going to take Sharapova's place, be the next Sharapova on tour? We'll see next week.
And the Williams sisters are both still in it. Venus Williams plays Aggie Radwanska. That probably already happened. We don't know, because it's Australian time is way ahead of us. And then Madison Keys plays Madison Brengel in another round of 16. Two Madisons, two United States girls. And Serena takes on Garbine Muguruza. I think she's going to mug her.
Well, yeah, I think you could be right. She's starting to play a little bit better now as Serena's. And I think we predicted last week, we both went for Serena to win this tournament. And, you know, you said her sister Venus. Venus is playing quite well this week. She's got a very difficult match against Agnieszka Radwanska. But I think it's quite bright. The women's draw for the United States tennis perspective, there's still four women there, the two Williams sisters and the two young Madison ladies. So it's quite bright for USA tennis. Now, I fully expect, given that they're all in the same half of the draw, that there's going to be an American finalist in the women's draw. And, you know, for you and I, that's going to be Serena Williams. But you never know. Maybe one of these young ladies will step it up and show us what they're made of.
That could be possible. You know, I think it's going to be Serena. I think it's going to be Andy Murray holding up the trophy. He's got a new coach, a female coach. That's been a big – we've talked about that numerous times. But the women's side of things, it's going to be fun. You've got Ekaterina Makarova taking on Simona Halep in the – one quarter final, as I mentioned before, Bouchard and Sharapova. Sloane Stephens got bounced. We talked a lot about that on This Week in Tennis, but overall, your thoughts on this tournament?
It's been different to how I had anticipated it at the start, and I'm sure anyone who wants to hear what we said last week on This Week in Tennis, when we made a few bold predictions, will see that, you know, some things have happened that we certainly didn't expect. And for the viewer, that's a fantastic thing, because you don't want to go in there predicting the results, knowing exactly what's going to happen. You want to be entertained. And I think we've been entertained. We're going to have some big match coming up this week. And I think we're going to have two worthy champions on Sunday.
Yeah, it's been an entertaining fortnight, that's for sure. There's still a week to go, though. Or I should say, an interesting, entertaining week. There's still 1 week to go. You can catch it every evening, like around 7:30 Eastern time it kicks off. And I think you can watch it on ESPN. Craig, thanks for being on the show with me. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Tennis.
We will. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. That was Craig Doyle. You can catch him over at CraigDoylePhotography.com. And that's going to wrap it up for today's show. Until next time, y'all take care of yourselves. Be good. And most importantly,
ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you, My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.